Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to summarize some of the big stories in science. Well, one story which has hit the headlines just last week was when Vice President Pence came out and laid out a blueprint for the Space Force. Yes, we're not talking about space cadets. We're not talking about the snickering that's going on behind closed doors. No, we're talking about a real program being pushed by the White House to the tune of $8 billion to set up the sixth branch of the military, the first new branch to be set up since 1947. And a timetable was even laid out by the vice president that by 2020, this new Space Force will be up and running. And the question is, well, what are the consequences of such a big change in our military structure, given the fact that, well, yes, let's not be naive about it. The Chinese, the Russians, a lot of nations are experimenting with killer satellite technology, which could be used in a potential war in outer space. So today on Exploration, we're going to talk about the pros and cons. The pros and cons of what happens when we weaponize the heavens. What happens when we have hydrogen bombs, laser cannons, kinetic energy weapons in orbit around the planet Earth. So we'll say a few things about the militarization of outer space, and then we'll say a few things about inner space. It turns out that one of the great afflictions, mental afflictions affecting humanity is depression. If you take a look at the sheer numbers, you realize that depression is by far the largest source of mental illness or mental impairment. And unfortunately, we scientists are like children when it comes to understanding the brain. However, at MIT, there was a very interesting breakthrough that was announced just this week, and that is they found a portion of the brain, a localized part of the brain that seems to dictate depression and pessimism and optimism. In fact, by manipulating this part of the brain, you can actually make animals more pessimistic and hence more depressed. Well, we'll say a few things about that on Exploration. Well, let's just jump right into the top story of the past week in science and politics, and that is the Space Force. You know, a lot of commentators sort of like snicker late at night talking about space cadets and has the president lost his marbles? Have they been sent into outer space? But I think this is a serious proposal that should be taken very seriously. In fact, some commentators have said that perhaps the president views this as one of his lasting legacies. Long after he's gone, the legacy will be the creation of a U.S. Space Force. And so the question is, what are the pros and cons concerning the establishment of a new branch of the United States Pentagon? Well, yes, it's full steam ahead for the Space Force. By 2020, the president wants to have it up and running, and immediately he's called for three initiatives that are already sending Pentagon officials into a flurry. First of all, he wants to set up a U.S. Space Command. It's been talked about, but now he wants to push it as a reality, a U.S. Space Command which will begin to assume some duties concerning monitoring outer space and making decisions. Next, hiring. Hiring that could begin as early as this year, hiring a core of experts who are skilled in the technology of warfare in outer space. And then satellites. Number two would be to buy satellites. So no agency of the government is fully functional unless it has control over its own satellites. And yes, the U.S. Space Command would be given the authority to buy satellites. And then setting up a command structure. This would become the nucleus of the U.S. Space Command. And of course, officials in the United States Air Force are not happy about this at all. In fact, even the former U.S. Secretary of Defense for the Air Force came out and made critical comments about a U.S. Space Force. But some of that has to be put into perspective. After all, the United States Air Force stands to lose an arm and a leg if the United States Space Force is created by taking huge chunks of the Air Force and putting it into a new branch of the military. So that has to be taken with a certain amount of a grain of salt. Now, it still needs congressional approval. The three initiatives I mentioned, including setting up a corps of experts and buying satellites and setting up a command structure, all of these could be done without congressional approval. However, ultimately, Congress has to weigh in. Congress has to say yes or no to the president's plan to create a new Space Force. Now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of a Space Force? It's one of the duties of scientists to analyze the pros and cons of any technology so that the public and politicians have the best scientific evidence available. Well, one of the advantages is, well, let's face it, space is getting cluttered. A huge portion of our digital economy is, of course, done in outer space. We're talking about the internet, GPS, weather satellites, telecommunications, commerce. The digital economy, let's face it, its future is in outer space. And so the question is, what would it take to disrupt the digital economy? Well, first of all, let's not fool ourselves. Of course, nations pay generals to win wars. They don't pay generals to lose wars. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians and the United States have all war-gamed different scenarios of war in outer space. So let's summarize now what is known and not known about the weapons capabilities of the great powers, starting with the Chinese. Back in 2007, over 10 years ago, the Chinese stunned the world of military science by shooting out one of its own satellites. The United States did not know that the Chinese had this capability 10 years ago. There was an old derelict Chinese weather satellite that was doing nothing. And so the Chinese then launched another satellite, which had the capability of shooting out the old weather satellite. It created enormous amounts of debris. Over 2,000 pieces of space debris were created by that. And of course, the Russians and the United States were furious about this because it cluttered up our space lanes, making it more dangerous for us to send astronauts into outer space. And then just a few years ago, something else happened which rattled the Pentagon. Just a few years ago, the United States tracked a Chinese missile being sent not just into orbit, which is, of course, just a few hundred miles from the surface of the Earth, but to the geosynchronous radius of 22,000 miles, where we have military and communication satellites vital to national security. The Chinese sent one of their missiles way out there, 22,000 miles from the surface of the Earth, and they buzzed one of our satellites. Of course, there was no damage done, but it was just sort of like a wake-up call. The Chinese were more or less announcing that, yes, they too had the capability that if they felt like it, they could wipe out U.S. telecommunications satellites and military satellites 22,000 miles in outer space. So the Chinese have shown that, yes, they are fully capable of fighting a war in outer space. Now, the Russians, of course, are even more advanced. They have publicly stated that they are working on new generations of space weapons. First, the laser cannon. It turns out that laser cannons can be used in, for example, ship-to-ship battles inside the atmosphere of the Earth over a close distance. But nobody has yet perfected an operational laser cannon which can shoot down a satellite from the Earth or blind a satellite from the Earth. That would be, in some sense, an act of war if that were to take place. But the Russians have announced that, yes, they are working on laser cannons. And guess who else is working on laser cannons? Yes, the United States is also working on laser technology, which can blind or destroy satellites by a push of a button from the planet Earth. Now, of course, there are problems with this. It turns out that much of the laser power is absorbed by the atmosphere of the Earth. And therefore, there are other plans to have other killer satellites with the capability of shooting out laser beams in outer space, where there is no atmosphere to absorb most of the energy. And also, the United States Pentagon has been complaining that both the Chinese and the Russians seem to be ahead of us in one category, and that is hypersonic weapons. Now, what the hell is that? First of all, we have supersonic weapons that can go a few times the speed of sound, but hypersonic weapons come blazing in from outer space many times faster than the speed of sound, capable of evading a Star Wars system. Now, let me explain. Ever since the days of Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s, the United States has spent billions of dollars trying to perfect a Star Wars system that can reliably shoot down Soviet missiles in a nuclear war. What do we get from it? Well, almost nothing. Even now, there is no operational system capable of knocking out an ICBM with accuracy and reliability in outer space. However, with not that much money, it's possible that an adversary can evade a Star Wars system by making their nose cones maneuverable. So as their hydrogen bombs enter the atmosphere over the Earth, they would then start to have fins which would allow them to maneuver at hypersonic velocities, thereby evading the radar and the detection systems of a U.S. Star Wars systems. And sure enough, in April of this year, Vladimir Putin announced that they have a hypersonic weapon that can indeed evade U.S. radar and U.S. Star Wars systems. Now, is that true? Well, we don't really know for sure. However, the military has publicly stated that they seem to be behind both the Chinese and the Russians when it comes to hypersonic weapons. Now, should we be concerned about this? Well, marginally, yes, because we are talking about weapons that are very difficult to control. It turns out that 2 years ago, the United States also had a hypersonic program, but it gave it up because it was too unstable. These weapons travel at enormous velocities, the velocities comparable to that of a nuclear weapon entering the atmosphere, and then to make them maneuverable and controllable was simply too much. And so the United States Air Force gave up on it 2 years ago. But now that the Russians and the Chinese have announced that they're making progress on this, we may see a revival of hypersonic funding. So now the question is, what does it all mean when you put it all together? So the positives are that a Space Force would be, in some sense, the cop on the block. More and more nations are sending probes into space. The Indians can do it. The Japanese can do it. They can reach the moon. They can reach Mars, in fact. So what the president is saying is that we're going to be the new sheriff in town. We're going to be the one bringing peace and order to the chaos of outer space, especially when it's so critically important to the economy and national security. Well, now let's look at the cons. Let's look at the problems involved with setting up a space force. First of all, the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock only to drop it on your own feet. In other words, things can backfire on you. And let's face it, who's the most vulnerable to a potential war in outer space? The Chinese, the Russians, are they the most vulnerable if war breaks out? No. We're talking about the United States. The United States has heavily invested in commercial satellites. In fact, over half the commercial operating satellites in orbit around the Earth today are American. And so if war were to break out, we would be the first ones to suffer the most. And how would it happen? It doesn't take much to knock out a satellite. Satellites are not reinforced. They usually don't have redundant systems. They can't maneuver unless they're military satellites with secret technology. And in a worst-case scenario, even a small nation like North Korea could detonate a hydrogen bomb over Kansas, let's say. The shockwave from the electromagnetic pulse would be enough to blind or disrupt about 50% of our satellites in outer space, blinding us. We would be blind without radar, without the internet, without telecommunications. And then when that radiation from that atomic bomb hits Kansas, we're talking about sending out an electromagnetic pulse that could affect communications, power plants, thousands of miles away. So we're talking about blackouts. We're talking about the fact that the internet not only goes down, but your TV set, your refrigerator, telecommunications are short-circuited by the electromagnetic pulse. When refrigerators are out, it means that in a few days, food riots could break out because all the food in the refrigerator starts to rot. Communications and the economy comes to a halt because, for example, credit card transactions cannot be lodged with the internet anymore because the internet is out. So we're talking about economic chaos that could break out if even a single atomic bomb were to be dropped over Kansas. And so you realize that, yes, we are the ones who are most vulnerable if a war were to break out. And then the next question is, well, what do we do about it? Reinforce all our satellites? Well, we have over 600 commercial operating satellites in orbit around the Earth, over 600. And are we going to reinforce all of them? It'd be impossible. We don't have the technology to maintain the servicing of that many satellites in outer space. So we have an Achilles heel. We are a sitting duck to a preemptive strike because we don't have any ways of protecting our satellites if an electromagnetic pulse were to be unleashed in outer space. Now, then you may say to yourself, is this science fiction? Is this for real? And the answer is yes, is for real. We have actually tested nuclear weapons detonated in outer space. Now, we've all seen pictures of hydrogen bombs detonated on the Earth. But yes, we have detonated hydrogen bombs in deep space as well. And we were shocked by the consequences. Back then, we didn't know about the electromagnetic pulse. So when we detonated a hydrogen bomb in outer space, all of a sudden we found that telecommunications was disrupted. For example, transatlantic communication between San Francisco and Tokyo was disrupted. In fact, in Hawaii, burglar alarms were set off over Hawaii because of the electromagnetic pulse. And since then, on the Earth, we have simulated the electromagnetic pulse and have exposed old airplanes to the electromagnetic pulse. If you simply Google it, you can actually see pictures of old airplanes whose communication systems were hit by an artificial electromagnetic pulse in the desert, just to see how badly we would be affected. And yes, it turns out that we have underestimated the power of the electromagnetic pulse. For example, if a hydrogen bomb were to be detonated on the Earth, the kill radius would be about 100 miles. 100 miles from ground zero, we're talking about enormous devastation because of the heat flash, because of the shock wave, because of the radiation released. However, if that same bomb were to be detonated in outer space, the electromagnetic pulse is not going to stop at 100 miles. No, it's going to go on for thousands of miles because there's no air to absorb all the radiation. And so we're talking about potential chaos that could erupt if a war were to break out in space. And the Russians and the Chinese have announced that if we do go ahead with a space force, then they're not going to sit back and simply twiddle their fingers. So what do we do about it? Well, let's go back to the 1980s and see what Ronald Reagan did about that situation. When he was briefed about what would happen in case a real nuclear war were to erupt, he realized that the arms race had to be managed. He had a two-pronged strategy. The first prong was, of course, peace through strength. And everyone remembers that. That was President Ronald Reagan's mantra when it came to increasing the funding of the Pentagon. Peace through strength. But he also cut a deal with Gorbachev. He realized that if a nuclear war were to spiral out of control, nobody would benefit. Americans would die just as quickly as Russians. So he cut a deal with Gorbachev. So some people are saying that what we ought to do is revise the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Now, that was 50 years ago, but the United States signed the Outer Space Treaty and is held to it. And the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 basically says two things. First, no nukes in outer space. And that's one reason why we have not detonated nuclear weapons in outer space ever since the first tests were conducted back in the 1960s. That's the first provision. The second provision is ownership of celestial bodies. No nation can claim the moon. Now, you begin to realize that this treaty is way out of date. Because now, in addition to nuclear weapons in outer space, we have advanced non-nuclear weapons in outer space, like laser cannons, like kinetic energy kill weapons, like killer satellites. Even a small nation, for example, can take a barrel of nails and detonate it in outer space. And the shrapnel coming from all these nails would be sufficient to wipe out any number of delicate satellites orbiting the Earth because they have no shielding. They have no protection. They have no Star Wars program of their own. And they're just sitting ducks out there. That's one provision. And back in the 1960s, who would have thought? Who would have thought that private individuals, not nations, but private individuals would have the capability of fielding a moon rocket and in principle put their corporate flag on the moon? That was considered preposterous 50 years ago, but guess what? Here we have Elon Musk, a hero to many visionaries who realize that, yes, private individuals are now capable of fielding moon rockets. And so the point here is that some people are saying that perhaps what we ought to do is rethink the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. This does not mean banning all research, because, of course, research can always be done secretly without anyone knowing about it. So we're not talking about banning everything. That's practically impossible. But we're talking about regulating it, monitoring it, setting the ground rules so that a confrontation in outer space doesn't simply flare up and become a full-fledged war in outer space, which we cannot win because we are the most vulnerable. And we're going to be the most vulnerable for decades to come. Because how are we going to reinforce the hundreds of satellites that we have orbiting the Earth at the present time? And so once again, perhaps Ronald Reagan, when he cut a deal with the Soviets, was not totally wrong in saying that, well, yes, we have to be able to manage a nuclear war so that it doesn't spiral out of control. In conclusion, there are several scenarios that could be played out over the next several years to decades. One scenario is that this initiative by the president is a harmless one. It's nothing but musical chairs, bureaucrats within the Air Force being shuffled around to create another bureaucracy, which simply adds to the U.S. debt, which simply adds to the taxpayers' burden. That would be the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is it militarizes space. The Russians and the Chinese say that, well, they too have to modernize their killer satellites. And an accident, the smallest accident, could spark a nuclear confrontation. However, I think the best outcome would be to revise the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. When you read it, it's like reading a comic book from the 1950s. It's so out of date. The capabilities today dwarf anything imagined by the politicians and scientists back in 1967. And so I think we should take a hard look at whether or not we can renegotiate the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 to bring it up to date, to make sure that the ground rules for outer space and conflicts in outer space are well known and well understood to prevent any spiraling out of a crisis. And lastly, I'd like to say a few things about, well, inner space rather than outer space, specifically what goes on inside your brain. Now, one of the greatest afflictions, mental afflictions of the human race is depression. It far outweighs the number of people afflicted by, for example, schizophrenia. 1% of the human race, approximately, are afflicted by schizophrenia, in which case you begin to hear voices. But depression, depending upon how you count it, at one point or other in a person's life, perhaps 20, 30% of the population is afflicted by depression. And what do we do about it? Well, we are children. Children when it comes to understanding the mechanisms of the brain. But if you get a copy of my earlier book, The Future of the Mind, we talk about some of the latest developments. First of all, there is counseling and therapy, which works pretty much as well as simply doing nothing and letting it run its course. So we do not have good statistics when it comes to counseling and therapy of that nature. Drug therapies work a little bit. However, we are simply children again when it comes to understanding the nature of dopamine and other neurotransmitters. However, recently, people have been able to pinpoint certain parts of the brain itself which are linked to depression. If you read my book, The Future of the Mind, you realize that there's one specific point of the brain which, if you stimulate electrically, can actually eliminate a very severe form of depression. However, there are many, perhaps hundreds of different kinds of depression, some of it genetic, some of it environmental, some of it developmental, and we're still clueless as to how to bring it all together. But at MIT just last week, it was announced that they found a part of the brain, the caudate nucleus, which seems to be involved in pessimism. Now, if you take a look at the animal kingdom, you realize that animals have to do a cost-benefit analysis. They have to say, well, if I reach out and grab that food, will I expose myself to possible predators? So there's a cost-benefit analysis that goes on in the brains of animals. Animals do this all the time whenever they try to eat. They analyze the risks involved. It turns out that if you stimulate this area too much, pessimism starts to rule. The animal becomes super cautious and shies away from taking any risks. And so this most basic circuit, the reward versus benefit circuit, actually is gradually being unraveled now by scientists. And of course, we humans have that as well. And the speculation is that this part of the brain is involved with depression. Because if pessimism becomes out of control, then we think that no matter what we do, we're going to fail, that we're worthless, that there's no point in attempting something because, well, we're not going to succeed anyway. And so even though this is certainly not a cure for depression, it gives us understanding of a possible pathway by which some people become depressed because of a feeling of hopelessness caused by depression. Next, of course, they're going to try to find the optimism area to see whether or not you can stimulate optimism in an animal and eventually in a human being as well. To sum up, we do not have a cure for depression that works all the time. However, because of science, we're gradually beginning to understand the mechanisms of the brain that may one day allow us to control debilitating mental illnesses like schizophrenia, like bipolar, and also depression. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to rerun a previous interview with Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst, who has spent a lifetime studying the pros and cons of war. Not just war on the Earth, but war in outer space. What would it be like if we actually had a war in outer space? Would we, the United States, be at a tremendous disadvantage because of the fact that, well over half the satellites that are operating in outer space are our satellites. And it wouldn't take much for even a small nation like North Korea to detonate a nuclear weapon to blind our satellite system. And so once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, talking about war in outer space. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In this part of Exploration, we're going to bring on a weapons analyst, Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, Michael Moore, the weapons analyst, talking about Star Wars and war in outer space. As we mentioned earlier, in March, Vladimir Putin announced a new weapon, the hypersonic glide vehicle, a weapon that can travel at Mach 10 or Mach 20 up to 20 times the speed of sound. It rides on an ICBM and can go right through any Star Wars shield, at least that's the claim made by the Russians. And the question is, are we entering a new phase in the arms race? That is war in outer space. Now, of course, at the present time, the great superpowers of the world are not shooting down each other's satellites. We're not talking about nuclear war taking place anytime soon. But the question is, are we entering a new phase of the arms race when we're putting weapons in outer space? What will a space war look like? And that's what we're going to talk about with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, who has studied the whole question. Are we entering a new phase of the arms race? Not between two superpowers fielding ICBMs, but warfare in outer space. When we attack each other's satellites, when we try to penetrate Star Wars shields, that's what we're going to ask today with Michael Moore, the weapons analyst. Also, we should point out that this program is pre-recorded from a previous interview. Now I'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. You know, the United States hit the moon just the other day. We bombed the moon. Does it have military value? Well, not really. However, there's a larger question, and that is in the future. In the future, nations will see space as a military asset. We saw that during the Gulf War crises. And then the question is, what steps, what secret steps are nations making right now, even as we speak, to prepare for a possible war in outer space? A war that could wipe out satellites. It could cause a tremendous collapse of the industrial infrastructure as power lines go out, communications go blank. The internet is stopped. It could cause all sorts of havoc if we have a war in outer space. So with us once again is Michael Moore. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in peace and disarmament issues?
I've been interested in peace and disarmament issues all my adult life, and certainly after we had children, it became a more personal thing to me. I've always thought nuclear weapons were clearly immoral, and that goes back to the 1950s.
And tell us about your involvement with the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Well, I became editor in 1991 and retired in 2000, and that was the end of the Cold War. Our circulation was slipping, and I told the board at my first board meeting we should be overjoyed that our circulation was slipping because that meant the nuclear threat was waning. But I got involved because I wanted to do whatever I could to ensure that nuclear weapons were never again used.
Okay. Now, most Americans don't know that there is a very fierce competition to dominate outer space. They heard about the Chinese test that took place several months ago, and many analysts were outraged that thousands of pieces of debris are now in orbit around the Earth as a consequence of the Chinese test. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Chinese test.
Well, it was a test in January of last year, and they smashed an alien weather satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, with a so-called kinetic kill weapon, which means they just ran into it, smashed it into many, many thousands of pieces. It replicated a test in a rough kind of way that we conducted in 1985. The Chinese test is interesting because the Chinese have wanted us to, us meaning the United States and the rest of the world, to negotiate a new outer space treaty that would prevent any kind of conflict in space and weapons in space and space-related weapons on the ground and so on. And we have dismissed that. Every time the Chinese have brought it up, we have dismissed the idea. And I regard it as a shot across the bow. The Chinese were saying, if you intend to dominate space, we're going to challenge you. But we would rather, the Chinese would rather, negotiate a treaty.
Okay. Now let's say a few things about the past, because most people were caught flat-footed when the Chinese test took place, not realizing that there's a long history of this going all the way back to the beginning of the space age. So isn't it true that even with the launching of Sputnik back in 57, there were voices talking about a potential war in outer space?
Oh, absolutely. And President Eisenhower anticipated this kind of thing as early as 1955 and established a space for peaceful purposes policy for the United States, because he did not want to see the Cold War extended into space. He thought that would be very dangerous. Then after Sputnik, a lot of people criticized Eisenhower for being flat-footed on this issue. Actually, he wasn't. But he was widely criticized. Even his own chief of staff of the Air Force, Thomas Dresser White, argued publicly in February of 1958 that control of space should be the goal of all Americans. But Eisenhower resisted that idea. He did not want to be the first president to militarize space. He did not want to see the Cold War go into space. And that policy was followed by Kennedy and Johnson and eventually became the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, an international treaty that is still in force.
But isn't it true that even during that period of time, the United States was in fact building killer satellite systems and in fact had an operational system based in the Pacific with Thor missiles that actually detonated hydrogen bombs in outer space?
It's true that the United States researched systems, and the Soviet Union was very aggressive when it came to space. The Soviet Union, until the Outer Space Treaty, was testing various systems. The Soviet Union was even talking about putting hydrogen bombs in space or in suborbital space. There were two different systems they were talking about, and the United States was reactive in that respect. We did have a Thor system with a hydrogen bomb warhead that was to be used as an anti-satellite system. But it was a very limited system. We could launch two Thors, which wouldn't have made any real difference. And then the system was activated, but in a very clumsy kind of way. It was clear to everybody that we didn't want to use it. Nobody really wanted to use it. Then later on, we did test nuclear weapons in space, and then one, the so-called Starfish Prime test, knocked out the electrical service in parts of Hawaii, and it killed a few satellites of other nations, and we realized that exploding nuclear weapons in space was not a good idea.
And isn't it true that Robert McNamara began to be a little bit skeptical about shooting hydrogen bombs in outer space because it would create an electromagnetic pulse? In fact, wasn't this the first time we've ever seen an electromagnetic pulse in action that could wipe out our own communication systems?
You're absolutely right. The electromagnetic pulse was perceived as very dangerous to our systems and to other kinds of systems, military and civilian.
And didn't Robert McNamara actually go ahead and try to deploy a anti-ballistic missile system called the Sprint, which never became fully operational and wasted billions of dollars?
He did. He was very skeptical of it. He was pushed into it by hardliners on the right, and it was viewed as a Chinese, anti-Chinese system. It was pretty well understood by then that we could not defeat a Soviet attack, but we believed that the Chinese would someday have missiles, and then the system would at least defeat a small Chinese attack. But it was only operational for a few months, and billions of dollars were spent. It was not popular with anybody except the aerospace industry and certain senators and congressmen.
Okay, so we went through the 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, President Ronald Reagan changes the whole landscape by talking about Star Wars, and people were talking about Buck Rogers-type laser particle beam accelerators in outer space, zapping things from outer space. What happened to the original Buck Rogers schemes?
Well, the Ronald Reagan's Star Wars scheme was kind of fantastical. He was sold on it by Edward Teller and some other people, and it was viewed as an anti-ballistic missile system, and we would have anti-ballistic missile systems in space. We would have battle stars in space and so on and so forth. It was a kind of a crazy thing. I have to say Ronald Reagan was far-reaching in one way. He believed that the mad system of mutual destruction was literally mad. He wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he believed that the Star Wars system would do that. Meanwhile, there were people on his staff and in his administration who viewed it as a way of advancing space control. If we had anti-ballistic missile systems, we could also have anti-satellite systems, and we could control space. But it just wasn't technically possible then. It may be technically possible now to hit satellites from space. It still isn't possible to hit ballistic missiles, in my opinion.
Now, if you do, in fact, have a Star Wars shield, isn't that also a potential first strike weapon? President Richard Nixon used this analogy. Nixon said, if you have two gladiators, the first gladiator strikes first, disarming most of the enemy's ability, and then you have a shield to absorb a weakened second strike from the second gladiator. So in some sense, this system is not only a defensive system, it's also an offensive first strike system, right?
You're right about that. Almost any defensive system of that kind can be viewed as part of a first strike system, and that's very dangerous. It's unstable, and that's why a lot of military people actually oppose these kinds of systems because of the dangers of being viewed as a first strike system. The people who push it most ardently tend to be civilians, people who have never been in war, don't understand war, and who have hardline ideologies.
Okay, so in the 80s came the big disappointment that Ronald Reagan's great schemes violated the known laws of physics and the known laws of technology. However, in the 90s, isn't it true that the United States kept on going with a limited off-the-shelf Star Wars system, shooting a bullet with another bullet over the Pacific?
It's true that in the 90s we continued these systems. But mainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, a new paradigm emerged, which had the support of a lot of military people as well as hardline civilian people. It went like this. The Cold War had been very dangerous to both the United States and the Soviet Union. We should not permit another existential threat to the United States. Therefore, the way to do that was to be overwhelmingly militarily dominant on land, at sea, in the air, and in space. And I'm very concerned about the space end of that, because the idea that space should be reserved for peaceful purposes is part of international law. But during the 90s, great progress was made in developing the doctrine for space control and even the hardware to exercise space control.
Okay, now take us to the present. Take us to the present in the sense of what are the capabilities of the United States, Russia, and China vis-a-vis space weapons? What's the state of the art today?
Well, the state of the art is this. The United States is many, 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 many years ahead of China and the United and Russia in terms of being able to control space with anti-satellite weapons. We are working on several techniques. The most important, really, is small robotic satellites that can be launched into space and seek and find and rendezvous with any satellite we want them to. And, of course, if you can rendezvous with another satellite, then you can do damaging things to it. We call these robotic satellites peaceful in that they could service future American satellites. But you can call that peaceful if you want. But if you can come up to another satellite and service it, you can also destroy it or damage it.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Michael Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And if you get the Science Channel, watch for a 12-episode series that I'll be hosting based on my best-selling book, Physics of the Impossible. 12 episodes that I'll be hosting for the Science Channel. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, author of a rather disturbing book called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Well, maybe you're one of the people that woke up early in the morning to watch us bomb the moon. Well, people ask the question, was there a military application to such technology? Well, the answer is yes, but rather minimal. It doesn't really take that much to bomb the moon. We can reach the moon in 3 days, which is probably too long if you're going to be fighting a nuclear war on the planet Earth. However, there really is a twilight war going on, not with regards to bombing the moon, but secret classified studies being done on space warfare, satellite warfare, killer satellite warfare, ASAT warfare. And with us today to discuss this is Michael Moore, the weapons analyst. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And when we last left off, we were talking about space weapons, and even lasers can be used in outer space to destroy or blind enemy satellites.
We're very far along in these programs. We're also working on a ground-based laser system that could damage or possibly even destroy satellites of other nations in space.
And in fact, wasn't there a Star Wars test, maybe 10 years ago, where the space shuttle was supposed to intercept a laser beam from the planet Earth? However, they misread inches and meters. And as a consequence of that, the media picked up on it. Because we misread meters and inches, the space shuttle oriented itself toward outer space rather than toward the Earth. And as a consequence, the Star Wars test failed. But isn't it true, therefore, that we are using the space shuttle to test space weapons in the sense that we shoot lasers, very low-power lasers, at the space shuttle?
Well, I wouldn't call those weapons tests. We are researching lasers, and in fact, we illuminated a satellite in 1997 with a low-power laser. But we are working on the technology. But the main thing we're working on are these robotic small satellites, because they have the potential for doing almost anything we want to in space. They have the potential for hitting targets in low Earth orbit, which are just a few hundred miles above the Earth, or in higher orbits, many thousands of miles above the Earth. That's where the big threat is right now, and other countries understand this. They're very very keen on developing a treaty that would stop the development of such weapons.
Now, isn't it true that smaller nations like India, being outgunned and being overwhelmed by U.S. technology, have issued some dark threats that they may launch what is called a keg of nails? A keg of nails would be a barrel of nails with gunpowder inside, very low tech. You simply detonate it in outer space, and since most satellites are European and U.S. satellites, these nails then basically wipe out a good chunk of U.S. systems.
Well,
so that's
one of the ultimate nightmares in the space business. It's very easy to destroy a satellite, any kind of satellite of any size, by putting debris, pellets, gravel, nails, whatever in the orbital path. And then that idea has been around for at least 40 years. And it's a terrible thing. If you do that, and if you do several of those, you could drain space almost forever.
Now, the question is, who would suffer the most if there is a showdown in outer space? The Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Now that the United States is reaching for superiority in outer space, the question is, will it drop it on its own feet? So who would suffer the most if war breaks out in space?
Well, you're getting to the heart of an important issue, a dispute between a lot of high-level military people, mainly in the Air Force, and civilian hardliners. High-level military people in the Air Force tend to argue we have the most to lose, meaning the United States. About 850 active satellites are in orbit, and about half of those, a little bit more than half, are American. So if we ever had a conflict in space, we would stand the risk of losing many, many, many of our own satellites. So the argument, and I've heard this from colonels and generals, the argument is, why are we being so belligerent in our space policy? Why are we using rhetoric and developing hardware that might start another arms race? Because if the arms race ever turns into a conflict, we do have a lot to lose.
Now, if you have two gunfighters about to shoot it out at OK Corral, and one gunfighter grabs sand and throws sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding the enemy, that's like space war, in which case the blinded gunfighter then shoots randomly in all directions. So if it does come to space war, not only do we have all the space debris in outer space, but won't the blinded enemies basically fire randomly and create even more havoc?
Well, that's another important argument. War games have borne this out, that if we play a war game, and if we, as you put it, blind the other side by damaging their satellite, there's going to be retaliation. It's going to be much more random than it would have been otherwise. It's a very dangerous business to take out the other nation's satellite. And I have to emphasize that a lot of military people are really against this aggressive space policy we're talking about. There's a real split here between hardliners, neoconservatives, triumphalists on the one side, and fairly sober military people on the other side.
Now, Vladimir Putin has basically gone ballistic over the Star Wars anti-missile system being based in Eastern Europe, even though the United States has tried to reassure it that it's basically to be used against Iran and, quote, rogue nations. The Russians are fuming that it's basically in their sphere of influence. So tell us what's happening now in Europe.
Well, you know, we are talking about having two facilities in Europe, and the Russians are very unhappy about that, because it would be a little bit like the Russians putting a couple of systems into Canada. I mean, it's right on their doorstep, as Canada is on ours. And if you put facilities on their doorstep, who's to say that 10 years from now that we won't use them in other ways as coercive tools against Moscow? It's a very ambiguous situation. Countries or national leaders look at the intentions of other countries, but they mainly look at capabilities. Intentions can change, but capabilities do not change so easily. And if one country has a lot of power in one area, they may say, we will not use it now, but 10 years from now, the intentions may change, and the Russians are very conscious of that.
And Putin even raised the stakes last year when he put his weapons basically on alert status and threatened Europe with nuclear retaliation. So this is really upping the stakes, right? And while in the United States there's almost no publicity around this, the Russians are fuming.
Well, they're fuming, but this alert business is rhetorical. Both countries, both the United States and Russia, have weapons on alert, and they say they're detargeted, but it's just a matter of, it would take a matter of minutes to retarget them. It's done for rhetorical effect. It's not a strategic change, in my opinion.
Now let's talk about China. If you read the Chinese concerns, first of all, they believe that a Star Wars system would decouple Taiwan away from mainland China. And China has said, more or less, that there's only one scenario, only one scenario in which they would unleash the power of their military, and that is over Taiwan. So isn't the United States touching very sensitive areas when there is a possible decoupling of Taiwan from China, in which case China has already stated that it will go to war?
Well, the Chinese-Taiwan situation, I think, has been handled very clumsily in this country. You're quite right. The Chinese will not tolerate a true independence move by Taiwan. On the other hand, the Taiwanese tend to act very independently in many areas, and we have sold them weapons for years and years and years. It's always a tense situation. And the space assets used for military purposes have accentuated this. One of the favorite war games being played in the military over here is, what if the Chinese launch a surprise attack against satellites, which are in effect surveilling China and Taiwan? What if they blind us? What do we do then? And this is kind of a silly scenario. The Chinese have no interest in taking on the United States militarily. They make goods for the United States. They make goods for the Western world, and they need those jobs. Meanwhile, we need the Chinese. The Chinese are buying roughly $200 billion worth of treasury notes and bonds every year. That keeps our interest rates low. We're in bed together financially, economically, so why would there be a military challenge from China? Why can't we cooperate? We're in a new century. I think the old Cold War paradigms don't work anymore.
And that concludes our interview with Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst. And we're talking about perhaps a new way in which nuclear war will be waged, a war fought in outer space, a war fought with satellites, a war fought with perhaps advanced weapons like hypersonic glide weapons that Vladimir Putin boasted about back in March. So let's hope that this new arms race doesn't get out of control. And once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.